Thanks, Neil. Hello, everyone. Yeah, so I'm Sai Chetanya from Wisconsin-Madison. Today, I'll try to discuss or probably present to all of you axionic blue isocurvatures. That has been my work in the past year. And we're also going to look at how does one forecast these using EFT of LSS. So the whole talk is divided into two parts. In the first half, I'll try to motivate how do you get blue isocurvatures and what constraints do you already have from blue isocurvatures, maybe look at a certain model. And then in the second half, we'll see how we go about doing some analysis in order to forecast these in the upcoming experiments. So as I said, I'll start with isocurvatures, and it's based on the following two papers. I hope you can, okay, yes, the cursor is seen. Now, I like to begin with the inhomogeneities that we already see in the universe. So this can be the inhomogeneity in the radiation, which is what we see is in terms of CMB, or the inhomogeneity in matter in terms of galaxies. Now, both of these inhomogeneities can be explained as though they were seeded by some primordial fluctuations. So, and then one can categorize these primordial fluctuations as either adiabatic or isocurvature. Now, what one actually means by adiabatic and isocurvature is that adiabatic, so let's consider there are n dynamical degrees of freedom during inflation. And so if there are n degrees of freedom, I can always construct one single common solution for all of them, and that's what I call the adiabatic solution. And the remaining n minus one solution become isocurvature solutions, and it's going to be pairwise. Now, another way to look at what adiabatic solution is that the common solution is going to be the one which is directly tied to the metric. So the fluctuations in metric are directly going to be tied to the fluctuations in each and every field, just because they are also going to be living in the same metric or in the same universe, space-time. So the fluctuations in metric can be directly mapped to the individual fluctuations in the field. And this is what then directly becomes my adiabatic, which is why we also come across this relation, which is if I'm looking at adiabatic fluctuations, then for CDM or the baryons or the gamma or the neutrino, they all follow this. And these can be directly derived if one starts with a gauge invariant definition, as probably I'll show in the next slide. The isocurvature, on the other hand, suppose I'm looking at CDM isocurvature. So that's going to be CDM fluctuations without the adiabatic part. And it's again classified in this case. So if the delta C here was just adiabatic delta C, then clearly this goes to zero purely because CDM adiabatic is given by this, and which is equal to 3/4 the adiabatic of the gamma. So this term goes to zero in case delta C was just adiabatic, but otherwise this term actually remains. Now, what does this actually mean? So as I was saying, one can then define a gauge invariant definition for the superhorizon curvature perturbation, and I can write this in terms of Newtonian potential and also in terms of the overdensity. Now, for each field I, or each field that I have during inflation, I can then define a gauge in this gauge invariant quantity for each of those fields. And adiabatic essentially implies that this quantity is same for all the fields which are living at the same time. And the difference between them is what we define then as the isocurvature. Now clearly, Sij is going to be, S is going to be negative of Sji, but then it's still going to be one same dynamical degree of freedom. If I'm, on the other hand, if I'm actually solving fluid equations, then one would not rather use these definitions, but in fact use this definition directly, the one given below, which is more useful when I'm actually solving fluid equations. So I'll say adiabatic is one way there is a net curvature fluctuation in the energy density. Delta rho is non-zero, so which essentially just becomes, I have a gravitational potential to begin with, but I have almost no isocurvature. And on the other hand, isocurvature would be that I have delta rho equal to zero in one of the cages if I can move to a certain cage. And in that case, I'll say there is no initial Newtonian potential, but in fact, there is an isocurvature component to begin with, which is also the reason why isocurvatures are slightly suppressed, because when you start solving for a system with an initial isocurvature fluctuation and forget about the adiabatic, because isocurvatures do not have any gravitational potential to begin with, the final solution that we get is slightly suppressed compared to an adiabatic one, because adiabatic already has a phi to begin with. So there is already a kind of gravitational well which is available to us. So given these differences between adiabatic and isocurvature, we'll try to see what we already know about these fluctuations. Right, and what I'm going to essentially be looking at here, we need an observable, right? So I'm going to be looking at the isocurvature spectrum. there is a bispectrum quantity one can define, but the leading order quantity that I'm interested in is essentially the isocurvature spectrum here. And we just define it as a two-point correlation, or in fact, in this case, the variance of this of the quantity S. Now, one thing to be seen here is that the isocurvature power spectrum, or the dimensionless isocurvature power spectrum, as this quantity is called, is often written in a power law form, k power ni minus 1, and I'm going to call ni the spectral index here. Now, for a field or a spectator field being a spectator if it is non-dominant during inflation, so inflaton being the dominant field, and then if there are any number of fields, let's consider a single field which is non-dominant during inflation, we call it a spectator field because it's just observing inflation go by. For those kinds of field, the ni minus 1 can often be written as this, and where m square chi is actually the mass of that spectator field during inflation, and h is my inflationary Hubble constant.
Does that depend on the potential of this?
Yes, it's going to depend upon the quadratic shape of my spectator field. And the curvature there is going to be m chi square, so that directly defines what my spectral index is. So which implies that detecting isocurvature with a blue index. Now, note one thing, for m chi square greater than h square, if it is, for m chi square which is non-zero, ni minus 1, ni is always going to be greater than 1. So you always get a blue spectrum for spectator fields. You cannot get a red spectrum or a slightly reddish tilt. A blue tilt is something where ni is greater than 1, and a red tilt is something where ni is less than 1. Primordial adiabatic fluctuation is known to have slight red tilt with NS about 0.97. That's not possible for spectator fields here. And so in future, if one does detect a blue isocurvature with a certain tilt, it actually gives us a view into what the mass scale of that specific spectator field was during inflation. Apart from the fact that since we do detect something in future, it implies the isocurvature should have survived, because isocurvatures actually get erased very easily. And if they survived, they had to have been carried by something which was very weakly interacting. So indirectly, it's telling us that if I detect an isocurvature in future, not just it gives me an indication into the mass of that of the spectator field which carried isocurvature, but also it tells me that it is kind of like a dark matter particle because it very weakly interacted, and the isocurvature survived for us to be seen today.
Sorry, can you go back again to your definition of isocurvature?
Yes.
For each additional field, you define one isocurvature. So you, in this case, have multiple isocurvatures.
Yes, yes. So let's say I have inflaton and axion field during inflation, just the two fields. So because inflaton field is going to be the dominant one, which will have, let's say, delta phi, phi being the inflaton field, and that's what's going to affect my metric perturbations. That metric perturbation will induce a perturbation on the axions because axion is living there, and that's called my adiabatic fluctuation of the axion. But simply, axion can also have its own independent fluctuations. Those will become its isocurvature fluctuations. So now there is only one isocurvature, which is embedded in the axion relative to the inflaton field. We always define in terms of relative to the radiation because we are interested in the late universe when things start building up after inflation. But other than that, if there are two fields, there is one adiabatic and one isocurvature.
And one addition.
Yes, and only one isocurvature, right. So if there were three fields, then I'll say one adiabatic and two isocurvatures. And then pairwise, each isocurvature essentially pairwise between them. Right. It might seem from Sij that if there are n fields, then there should be n minus 1 square isocurvatures. But actually, there are relations which will show you that there are only n minus 1. There is redundancy in this matrix, which is why it's not n minus 1 square solutions, but only n minus 1 solutions.
I thought single field inflation had two solutions, one decaying.
Yeah, so we are looking at the dominant solution here.
They're both adiabatic.
Yes.
So, may I ask about that for a minute? So, the next slide, actually.
Oh, okay.
Does this depend on, like, the field is living at the bottom of the potential or like at different locations?
The part of this power spectrum that we see Suppose if I have a power spectrum, and I'll actually show the power spectrum where at different slopes, and you get different shapes. So the shape or the Ni is directly tied to the part of the power spectrum where it is living in. So the shape, where exactly it is, it lies. And if that shape can be defined in terms of a quadratic shape, then you get this kind of a spectral index. And the one which I'm going to study here, or rather I'm going to show here, is going to be purely in terms of the quadratic. There is a reason why people, so for axion, of course, one should also ask, what about the quartic part of the potential? The reason one does not really look into the quartic part of the potential is because you get parametric resonances, unless we do some fine tuning, which is also something I'll just barely touch upon.
That doesn't seem like a good reason. It seems that we should be looking at the quark. If you get parametric resonances,
yes,
you cannot ignore it.
we cannot ignore it, and that's what we. I don't have time to discuss it in detail, but I'll show what results we have right now with it and how one can avoid parametric resonance in certain cases. But of course, it all depends on what initial condition one has. If you satisfy certain initial conditions, which we have been calling conformal boundary conditions, then you do not get parametric resonance. So what do we know about isocurvatures till now? Now, Planck has already given us good amount of information. We know that isocurvatures cannot be more than 2%, but that's only on CMB scales. So it's about, so right. The plot I see here is my dimensionless power spectrum. And on the x-axis, I have the wave number or the k scale. So the Planck is barely going to be constraining here. And that tells me that isocurvatures are not more than 2%. On the other hand, given that my adiabatic power spectrum is nearly flat with a slightly radius tilt, the 2% would imply if I have a flat isocurvature, which is also completely flat across all the scales, then it should lie about a factor of 100 below it. So on the other hand, one can come up with a situation where you have rather a blue tilt for the isocurvature. So the place where we have all the constraints, the blue isocurvature, which goes something like this, already satisfies all the constraints that Planck has placed. But on very small scales, it can start increasing. And then eventually, it will settle down and can also do some of these oscillations. So in this case, the slope is greater than 1, which is why this is a blue isocurvature. Now, apart from Planck saying
So in this scenario you're imagining, mm-hmm. That Hubble is evolving quickly during inflation?
No.
So why does this n change so much?
I'll explain why the n is actually changing and what models will give rise to this kind of a large change in n. This is only happening for isocurvature. Adiabatic still remains as slightly radius tilt, so it is still a slow roll during these scales that we are interested in.
And just to sort of orient for me, would you characterize curvaton as a spectator field, by your definition?
Yes, we can, I think, classify curvaton as a spectator field, and then if that curvaton eventually will decay, and so those isocurvatures will become curvature perturbations. But then it depends, when does it decay, how much is the decay fraction of that energy going into the actual adiabatic. So it will then depend whether how much of isocurvature will get converted to curvature perturbations. And so here I'm looking at, rather I'm interested in axions, which are not curvatons. So those isocurvature that we generate here in primordially, we are going to detect today. So I'm interested in situation where my isocurvature is not, extinguished. So I'm interested in situation where we actually see. And we'll see how do you generate a blue isocurvature here. Why do you get a blue tilt?
So just another question. Mm-hmm. So the oscillation, that's just a transfer function for isocurvature?
No, that's something which is very uniquely tied to the physics of the potential that I'm going to consider here. The one thing which is very generic to all these blue isocurvature is whenever you have a blue tilt, it has to eventually become flat. It cannot forever continue. Almost every single paper considers a situation, or every single paper I've come across, which actually does some analysis of forecast to blue isocurvature, just assumes it continues forever. Yes, that is also fine to some extent because you are assuming that cutoff occurs much later compared to what my experimental data can. But then there are other models which actually tell you that this cutoff can actually occur about 1 megaparsec or slightly before 1 megaparsec. And then it can be really interesting from those perspectives.
Is that because of a theoretical?
Sorry?
The reason it cannot go up forever, is it because of the UV cutoff? Or?
It's because if I have a, so the tilt of a spectator field of the isocurvature is uniquely tied to its mass. So if a spectator field was massive during inflation, it will automatically have a blue tilt. And I think that's also partly answers your question why it has a blue tilt, because if I consider a spectator field which has this kind of a potential, then automatically this is what will lead to a Ni which is greater than 1. Now, but the problem with this situation is if I have a spectator field which is massive and has a mass m chi square, which is even slightly greater than h square, then it will also undergo a Boltzmann suppression in its energy density. So you cannot have a spectator field which is massive throughout inflation. It will have a blue tilt, so the blue tilt will keep continuing, but the overall energy density of chi will also keep dropping, and it will drop something like this, something order of that. And because this number is greater than 1, the energy density will keep going down and down and down. And then at the end of inflation, you hardly have any energy density. So although you have blue isocurvature, there is nothing left to show that blue isocurvature today. So you have to have a situation where the mass should suddenly become 0 sometime during inflation to conserve that isocurvature. And as soon as mass becomes 0, you cannot have a blue tilt. The tilt becomes flat automatically. Because if mass becomes 0, then Ni becomes 1 by this condition here. Right, so this becomes 0, this root comes out 3 over 2, and then it becomes 1.
To clarify, I'm not sure. So when you said there'd be nothing left to see, mm-hmm. as in there'd be no observable effects of the isocurvature?
Yes, there will be no observable effect, because those isocurvatures will be carried by some field, and if that field's energy density is hardly significant today, then I don't see how the isocurvatures will be observed today. Yes, but apart from Planck saying there's 2%, there's something good enough to consider. There's a 2 sigma hint which was found if one considers Bos TR12. It's a 2 sigma hint, not statistically significant, but something for both theorists and observationalists to keep looking at. A 2 sigma hint can become something more. So the current data from Planck and Bos actually supports isocurvature with a blue tilt at 2 sigma level. So which is why it's kind of interesting. But
sorry, but with half degree parameters, you have an extra parameter n and a bit an amplitude.
Mm-hmm. Yes, extra parameter n and also the amplitude.
So this 2 sigma, does that account for that you have?
The 2 sigma is on the amplitude, not on the tilt here. But once you include Bos DR12, so Planck by itself gives a constraint of the amplitude at about 0.6 alpha. I'll come back to what alpha is here. I don't want to rush. But it doesn't say anything about the tilt. Planck just cannot probe enough or has enough sensitivity to say anything about the tilt.
Do you assume a tilt to get that
off? Sorry?
Do you assume a tilt?
Yes, we do assume. We do keep a free tilt. So if you look at Planck 2018 paper, they do consider a situation where they consider axion different models. One such axion model has a free tilt, and that free tilt model actually has much better fitting compared to other models. But then they do not have any good constraint on the tilt as such. On the other hand, if I add the Bos DR12 data, 12th data release, then it gives 2 sigma at high blue rather. So for spectral index about 3. And again, I'll show why all these data are more sensitive to high blue and not rather low spectral indices. Apart from isocurvature, there are also other sources which give rise to small. So what blue isocurvature does, I have a situation where I have adiabatic going this way, and this is adiabatic and blue isocurvature going this way. So beyond a certain scale, let's say K0, isocurvatures are definitely going to overpower. We probably are probing just this part. So there are other situations where one can get isocurvatures and not just from a spectator field during inflation. You can get PBH generated isocurvatures that has been studied in this case. It generically gives rise to only a KQ power spectrum, so which means the Ni here is 4. So that I get KNi minus 1 as KQ. I can get blue isocurvatures from phase transition, once again a K-cube, post-inflationary PQ, spontaneous symmetry breaking. The situation that I'm going to consider is in the PQ symmetry is broken during inflation. But there are situations where you can do the same thing post-inflationary. Again, it gives rise to a K-cube. So I'm just trying to motivate that there are other models which are, there are several other models which actually suggest that there can be an isocurvature which is blue. Most of those models give a very strict K-cube isocurvature. Lumpy dark matter, I won't definitely say it's an isocurvature, but it's something which gives rise to large power on small scales. Can be K to power N, and it hasn't been motivated much. What should that N be? But it's fine. It's good enough for us to say that, yes, there are models which gives me a large power on small scales. And then, yes, why study blue isocurvatures? Now, as I said, I'm mostly interested in axionic blue isocurvatures. And apart from non-Gaussianity and gravitational waves, detecting blue isocurvature definitely gives me a window into the inflation and tells me what the mass scale of the spectator field was. And if I do detect something today, then it tells me that spectator field was very, very weakly interacting, can be an axion, and in that case, it is also kind of like a dark matter for me.
Just here again, to orient myself. So these would be, all of them would be sub-Hubble or sub-horizon because they're happening after inflation.
Mm-hmm.
So you need weakly interacting because you don't want them to be washed away.
Then the theorem in this specific ARC paper also says that if I detect blue isocurvature with a spectral index greater than 2.4, then it has to have been from a spectator field with a time-dependent mass. All it says is that you cannot have a forever going blue isocurvature with an NI greater than 2.4. You have to have it cut off at some point, and that just tells me that the mass should go to zero, otherwise the energy density will simply dilute away. So based on those arguments, it was calculated that NI, if you detect NI greater than 2.4, then it's very difficult to model it into a situation where the field remains massive throughout inflation, because you won't have anything else, anything left to observe today in terms of energy density. The blue isocurvature also helps relax the HFPQ constraints in the parametric region. And as I was saying, that there can be bumps in this from certain models, and if those bumps can actually be complementary to cosmological collider signals. So in that case, the bumps actually give us information about what interactions were going on during inflation. So these can be studied complementary to the cosmological collider, and that is also something I'm interested in. So how do you generate blue isocurvature? So now I'm going to consider the model of Kasuya and Kawasaki here, 2009. Consider a complex scalar field, and I'm going to parameterize as some radial field and as some axial field using this kind of a parameterization. Now, we are going to assume that the radial field is displaced far away from the minimum of the potential being this region here. And during inflation, as this field starts rolling down, the potential, the isocurvature quantity, which is given here in terms of the root of the dimensionless power spectrum, is effectively, in the denominator, it has r theta, with r theta just being a from this. If a over r is theta, then a just becomes r theta. And as it rolls down during inflation, r goes from a very large value, Planck scale, let's say, to FPQ. FPQ, the value it has at this, at the minimum, the wave of the radial field. Now, because r keeps changing from a large number to a small number during the time it is rolling down, my isocurvature definitely goes from a small value to a large value. So all of the modes which were exiting during the time when this was, so if there was a mode which exited, let's say when the radial field was here, its amplitude would be much, much suppressed compared to a mode which exited when the radial field was here, purely because of that R in the denominator. So this is how you generate a blue isocurvature, by demanding that the radial field is dynamic and not just statically sitting somewhere else. Now, what it actually does, if I start with this definition for the phi, write down the Lagrangian for the complex scalar field, and then using this parameterization, write down, again, equation of motion for radial and axial field, I will see that the actual equation of motion for the axion changes to something like this. So this tells me that as long as the radial field is dynamic, as long as the D'Alembert R is not zero, axion actually gets a mass. So axion is massive during inflation, only during the time when the radial field is moving. And as soon as radial field settles to its minimum, that term in the Dalem version R goes to zero and axion becomes massless. So this naturally gives rise to a situation where the isocurvature fluctuations are blue. This is during the time when the radial field is going down. And as soon as radial field settles, you get a flat isocurvature. So as I was saying, during the time when radial field is going down, axion is massive. When radial field settles to the minimum, the axion becomes massless. And accordingly, during this time when the axion is massive, you get a blue tilt in the spectrum for all the modes which exit during this phase. And the modes which exit during this phase, the isocurvature is flat. Now, there can be certain oscillations which are decided by what happens during this transition, but it's not a one-to-one correspondence, as I'll try to show.
Question.
Yeah.
Probably showed, it becomes complex if MA is bigger than Hubble.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
So this one, right?
Yeah.
So it will. It just shows that n, so ni minus 1 will become 3 plus, let's say, some imaginary number here. And that will mean that there is a tilt. But on the tilt, if I have k to the power ni minus 1, where this is just an imaginary number apart from a k cube, this can be written as, it can be written as log oscillations, actually, of the imaginary times some k. So there will be some long scale oscillations on top of this. But again, if you there's hardly any sensitivity of the data to detect these kind of oscillations. It's only for very, very futuristic case where once you detect a k cube, can you then start seeing these oscillations on top of k cube? If yes, then clearly it's coming from the imaginary part, and then you actually have a massive isocurvature, massive spectator field. By massive, m chi squared over h squared is greater than 9/4. But then there is, you don't have to really wait till here. That's what I'm trying to say. We don't have to wait to see these tiny oscillations on the k cube, because as soon as m chi squared over h squared becomes greater than 9/4, one would say that, okay, this is sort of going towards a Boltzmann suppression. These fields should be Boltzmann suppressed, so the isocurvature is definitely going to be suppressed. But no, because there is a resonance which occurs in these kind of models, which will, so I'm going to skip this because that's not very necessary. It's just what model one is looking at, so I just gave one of the models. But rather, what's happening during the phase when it's going from a large radial wave to a FPQ, effectively. Something like this.
Yes. The isocurvature action story that I was familiar with is the story by Fox, Spears, and Thomas, that you produce the action fluctuations from just inflationary fluctuations.
Mm-hmm.
And then actually the back value of the action as it rolls down, it's kind of not important, right? You're just like kicking the action during inflation. You get isocurvature fluctuations from that. The power spectrum of that just depends on Hubble times k cubed.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the story that you're presenting?
No, I think the situation, I'm not familiar with that situation, but as long as you have a field, as long as you have a situation where there is a radial field, which is, I'm not sure if they consider a situation where the radial field is displaced away from its minimum. Most cases, people just consider that the radial field is sitting at its minimum, and then the back and forth of the theta direction gives me isocurvature. But what we are saying is, let radial field be here. Even here, the axial field can undergo back and forth, but then that back and forth, which is the isocurvature, purely because the radial field has a curvature right now and it's not, it will embed a curvature on my axial field. And that comes directly from the equation of motion. And so most situations usually consider that the radial field is sitting at the minimum. And then let's look at the isocurvature, which is going to be flat, but now it's rolling down. And that leads to a mass for the for the axions.
So, well, since you are on this slides, should I think of like this field as rolling down?
As?
Like your radial mode,
mm-hmm.
rolling down slowly, like how much energy does it?
Oh, no, we'll let it roll down as it would do in any m square potential, m square, r square potential. So depending upon what mass I give to this m square, let's say chi field, or the radial field, sorry. So whatever this mass is, it will go down exactly with the same rate.
Like much bigger.
So it's actually, if it is extremely larger than Hubble, then it's going to roll very fast. And so there are not much, there is not much window for the K-cube, because once it rolls very fast, there are only very few modes which can exit, and then it becomes completely flat.
So, like, if that's the case, like, then I'm a little bit confused with your delta A being like all the Hubble.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, as you are rolling down, like, in the radial direction,
mm-hmm.
you're exciting this angular direction
mm-hmm.
in dynamics, right?
So, oh, this delta A being h over 2 pi is only caricature. And I just wanted to show here through some means that assuming delta A is massless, then I'll say this is h over 2 pi, and then again, A being r theta. It's only a caricature way to understand why you get blue spectrum, but actually, as you said, delta A is not going to be h over 2 pi. It's going to be slightly complicated, then h over 2 pi, and then A is going to be r theta. But
so you are solving it on...
Yeah, we are solving it precisely as it is going to be in this. So this is the equation of motion for the background axial field, and then we construct an equation of motion for its perturbation, linear perturbation, solve that, starting with a bunch Davis. But just to make sure, just to give a intuitive understanding of what's going on, I wrote this. Right, and as I was saying, the radial field starts here, and let's say it rolls down. Now, the radial field just doesn't straight away stop here. It can actually roll over on the other side. It can also slosh around here. And those are the things which give rise to some interesting resonances. And this naturally occurs when the mass is actually, if the mass of the radial field is larger than Hubble scale. Because then the curvature of this potential is actually large. And so the field can actually oscillate back and forth. Oh, I would say this situation. So it can actually oscillate back and forth, and it can also cross over. So this is an overdamped situation where the radial field mass is less than 9/4 of Hubble, and an underdamped situation is greater than 9/4 of the Hubble, just as in a simple harmonic oscillator.
MR and then MA, which one are they the same thing?
Oh, yeah, they are the same thing here. Because the equation of motion for R would come out to be M square RR. So it automatically becomes almost the same thing. So the axial field gets the same mass as the radial field. But in the situation where it's underdamped, so even if there is a slight underdamp, so let's say I am slightly above 9/4, so we are looking at a situation where at 9/4 plus 0.01, even with this much, all of a sudden the axial field, the mass of the axial field starts getting these resonant oscillations. And these are much larger than the usual Hubble order mass scale that you get here. So the overdamped case, you just get a Hubble order mass on the mass square. Hubble order mass. And in the other case, even with a small increase, you get these large oscillations. And this is because of the cubic nonlinearities which occur here, essentially. So a dominant part of the work was, let's try to understand what's going on here and what kind of spectrum can it give. And then, as I was saying, because this is uniquely for 9/4 mass squared greater than 9/4, that means I do not have to wait to see that m greater than 9/4 in these small oscillations, but rather I'll get huge oscillations here. So I can detect m squared greater than 9/4 situation much before actually detecting any other situation, just by looking at this place where it transitions. So this is also the part which is going to be most sensitive to the spectrum or to the detector and experimental data. And this is also the part which is going to be most readily generated in large quantities by m squared greater than 9/4. So there is more future for m squared greater than 9/4 than m squared less than 9/4, actually. And what kind of... So we did. I just employed several analytical techniques to try and...
Question. What is the x-axis here?
X-axis is time during Hubble. This is, good question. It's just your normalized time, so number of e-folds rather.
Okay.
And TC is where the transition is taking place. So that's the time when the radial field almost touches the minimum, and then quietly settles. In this case, it doesn't seem as if it's settling down. It's actually doing a lot more. Right. not going into this. So, but we use these techniques to try and understand what essentially is going on. And in fact, what we can see here is that the mass of the axial field and then it undergoes some these resonances. Using the analytical framework, we actually say that this can be understood much easily in terms of this kind of a mass model. So effectively, we say that during the time when the radial field is rolling down, the axion has a mass, positive mass, some C plus quantity, and some constant quantity. And then subsequently, there is a tachyonic dip. And that tachyonic dip occurs during the time when it is almost at the bottom, followed by an almost exponentially decaying potential. So now the modes which exit during this time will all get a blue spectrum. The modes which exit during this time, or the modes which are still subhorizon, they enter the tachyonic well, get amplified. And then as they exit the tachyonic well, they'll undergo quantum scattering because of the positive potential, which is also decaying. And the non-adiabatic mass or the tachyonic mass, as we see here, doesn't directly, it's not trivially obtained from this, but in fact, it's due to a rotation of the axion eigenvectors in this case. I'll probably talk more about this, but maybe later, if you're interested, I can show what I mean by axion eigenvectors here and why the rotation of axion eigenvectors give rise to this situation. Maybe I can, an easy way to see is that the axion right now has, so there are two eigenvectors to the solution. One eigenvector is the one which the axion essentially tracks, but all of a sudden it becomes massless. So there is a mixing between the two eigenvectors which gives rise to a massless state. And when axion goes from one eigenvector state to a combination of those two, it gives rise to this adiabatic or tachyonic well of all of a sudden. The axion suddenly for a brief time becomes tachyonic. And this only happens when m squared is greater than 9/4. It does not occur other than that. So you get this kind of a power spectrum. So it's k cube on this side. So I have two power spectrums shown here, dimensionless power spectrum normalized with some factors, and k on this side. Ai is at the scale factor at the time the field starts to roll down. H is inflationary Hubble scale. So it's k cube on this side, and then as soon as the radial field starts to settle, you get these oscillations, and these are actually quantum scattering oscillations. These are not, there is no one-to-one correspondence between these oscillations that we see and this oscillation that we see here. In fact, the oscillations are purely because of this kind of a system. So if you see the mass model, there is no oscillation in mass model. And what oscillations we see are those are quantum scattering modes. And because of the tachyonic well, you can in fact get an amplification of some of these modes of the order of 1,000, which is why m squared greater than 9/4 is such an interesting case. Although one would assume that these modes should be, these cases should be dynamically or Boltzmann suppressed, but you get these kind of order 1,000 or order 10 amplification purely because of the tachyonic well, brief, small tachyonic well which is created. And only some of the modes will get amplified because you also have to have a matching condition when those modes are entering the tachyonic well. And so I believe these situations are more palatable to upcoming data rather than a situation where it just becomes flat and then one isn't sure what to make of that flatness or the data. If it detects anything, we are kind of not sure what to do. And then because of these amplifications, I'm interested in looking at maybe some PBH or axion mini clusters, because these bumps that we see are effectively for the axion model that I'm considering here.
So, like axion is a compact field direction.
Mm-hmm.
How do you account for that?
Sorry?
How do you account for the fact that like the axion is a compact field direction?
I don't get how do I account for it. But these are the.
Can oscillate on top, right? Like, does it go around?
Yes, it can also go around, right? But I think this is going to be the axial direction here, and so we of course start with a situation where let's say there is a theta I, there's an initial angle along which the axial field will effectively settle. So it's about here. Because during the time, as long as the radial field is dynamic, whether it's going down the potential or whether it's oscillating here, that automatically leads to a dynamic resonance that's happening for the axial field. And so even though the axial field is just going back and forth along theta I and generating those delta theta are sensitive to what's happening with the radial field, purely because they are coupled and they are part of the same complex scalar system. And that's what leads to, so although the theta is bounded, it's bounded between minus pi and pi, but the fluctuations can in fact be large. And I'm not saying that these, it might appear that these fluctuations are going beyond the perturbativity bound, which is probably what you were saying, that why is it going so large? But it's just because of the scaling that I have here. I just scaled with some parameters, and those parameters can still make it below the perturbativity bound. So things are still fine.
Perturbativity, like what do you mean?
I believe delta square 1. So if delta square becomes greater than 1, then we are kind of going towards a nonlinear regime, breaking the perturbativity bound. Of the variance, the variance
have
become.
Which is like the vorticity in your simulations?
No.
Okay.
So I guess maybe another way of asking the question, what is the maximum delta theta that you get?
Maximum delta theta. I think it's still of the order of h over 2 pi. At exactly at this point, it's still of the order of h over 2 pi. And then there are amplifications on top of that. So yes, a perturbativity bound will be broken if delta theta is almost close to the theta, or almost of the order of theta. And then I'll say my fluctuations are as large as my actual theta value. But no, even though we see that these values are 10, all I'm trying to say is that after scaling, appropriate scaling, these bounds and even this amplitude and everything, they're all going to be less than 1. So because the isocurvature here is delta theta over theta, and if I say that this quantity square is less than 1, then I'm still saying that delta theta is much less than.
That is a bit confusing, because you are saying like it goes over the hump, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like your delta theta can be pi, right?
No, delta theta cannot be pi. Because if delta theta becomes pi and theta is order 1, then already I'm going to.
Yeah, but
I'm kind of breaking the perturbativity bound.
Going over the barrier.
Sorry?
Then what do you mean when you say like the radial mode go over the barrier? Because like if it goes over the barrier onto the
outside. Okay. Right. Sorry. When I said the radial field is going over the barrier, I mean the radial field in the sense, so the theta value is still going to be theta because it's a two-field system actually.
Yes.
So it crosses the barrier of the two field system in this case. So it's not that the theta value is changing. How do I explain this? So if I take this potential V and I draw the potential V, so what I meant to say, it starts off with a situation where phi plus is extremely large, rolls down. During that time, phi minus is extremely small. And then it can roll over the 0, 0 of this potential, where phi plus and phi minus both are 0, and then roll to the other side of the potential. It's that kind of a rolling which is giving me the enhancement in the theta. But the theta value is still exactly the same. Now I'm looking at a three-dimensional system where I have theta, I have phi plus, and I have phi minus. And in fact, theta also is theta plus and theta minus, four-dimensional. So only for the sake of simplicity, I said theta and phi. The rolling takes place in phi plus phi minus field, with theta being constant. Theta is exactly constant throughout this. And due to the rolling of phi plus and phi minus, I'm looking at delta theta then, along that single theta direction.
In the SUSY model?
In the SUSY model, yes.
Like, what about like just in the normal Wien potential model?
In the Wien potential model, I think in the Wien potential model, you won't get the resonance that we are looking at. In this kind of a case, the theta can definitely change if it goes to the other side. Because as you said, it's this way, and then the theta value can actually change if it goes to the other. It starts off at one theta I, and then if it rolls, it ends up being on the other side of the theta. And then even then, as long as I can ensure that my delta theta is smaller than theta, whatever theta it ends up being, it's fine. As long as theta is order 1, then my delta theta is order h.
That I don't quite agree, but like I think like you should be careful.
Okay. Yeah, I think I can discuss this in detail later. Right. Any other questions? So these solutions were for the SUSY model that, as I was showing there. And the SUSY model also, that specific model also says, so if I have a large kinetic energy, in fact, there can be situations where if I have large kinetic energy as the field is rolling down, I can also end up with a situation where you have chaos setting in. So what we see on the x-axis is some parameterization of my kinetic energy for the radial field as it is rolling down. On the y-axis, I have the amplitude, overall amplitude of the isocurvature, again, normalized. And as the kinetic energy keeps increasing, you get this kind of a slight increase in the amplitude. But then subsequently, after a certain point, which is which we can define as some alpha CH as the point where the chaos sets in, you lose predictivity in the amplitude now. So any value of alpha here can give rise to any other values of the amplitude. And this is something which is really interesting. And then so if I detect an isocurvature amplitude today, there is no way I can map it back to a Lagrangian parameter or set of Lagrangian parameters or the models which appeared in my Lagrangian because of this chaos which sets in. And so that was studied in this specific work. There is another situation that we are looking at.
What was alpha C here? What is the x-axis in that?
Oh, right. Alpha C is a parameterization of my kinetic energy as the field is rolling down, some specific parameter. So alpha C here is, this kind of a parameter, FPQ.
And the y-axis is the number?
Y-axis is my isocurvature amplitude, and normalized to this part, so this isocurvature amplitude.
Just at that core?
Yeah, exactly. And then so what we are trying to say, you get a slight increase, and then subsequently, after that, the chaos sets in, and so there's no way to give a right prediction on this.
But I don't understand. I thought you had this weird shape with bumps, so you don't have a corner like that.
Oh, but I'm just giving, so this is a case set just to understand the chaos that sets in. And so what should happen, you get the first bump. So if I get slightly before, so when it starts deviating away from KQ, so this is KQ, but you get the first bumps and all the other bumps. So exactly where it starts deviating, that's where we define the N amplitude here in this case. And we are trying to see what happens to that N amplitude. So in this detailed work, we have actually shown that even the bumps can become unpredictable. You do not get the same bumps. In just with a slight change in the value of alpha, you get from this amplitude or this to this with a very small change. So you get this, and then all of a sudden, if I change my parameter with 0, 1, 1, I can get this kind of an amplitude, which is much smaller. And then, and in fact, trying to say there is no predictivity in the model anymore. The rolling in the previous case of the radial field was all quadratic rolling, where you have rolling along a phi squared kind of a potential. Now you cannot, we were trying to think what about phi four potential, but then phi four potential leads to parametric resonances, and then are there other ways to avoid parametric resonance? And yes, one such way is to actually say that the axion was probably rotating initially. So this is another case that we are looking into. And if I consider the situation where the axion was initially rotating, then as it is rotating along the phi 4 potential, the parametric resonances, so if this is phi 4 part of the potential and somewhere here it phi 4, then instead of rolling down this way, it actually spirals down. And when that happens, it actually rolls down slowly enough because it's not directly going down, but rather spiraling down. So the rate at which it goes down is inverse of the scale factor. So, and that effectively leads to a k-square potential. So a k-square potential is uniquely tied to these kind of systems. You do not get a k-square. You can get k-square potential from a spectator field which has a mass m square equal to 2h square, but apart from that, these kind of rotating system uniquely only give a k-square potential. Yes.
You ever hear of spin tessens?
Yes, yes. This is almost exactly same. In fact, this was inspired by, we were doing some model fitting in this work, and while doing model fitting, my advisor said, can we think of a situation where we get anything else? And we came across this axion misalignment, and then I had also read spin tessens, and I thought, can I try to do that during inflation? And it so happens, yes. But then there is a subtlety here One has to do a consistent quantization of the system because the radial field and axial field satisfy this kind of, that the commutator between them is not zero, this commutator. It means there is a strong coupling between the radial and axial field, and so we need to do the quantization very well. And just a few days back, I suddenly came across this paper by Senatorian group, and they studied this kind of a rolling system from the point of view of Lorentz invariance breaking. They were looking at S matrix, but they had exactly the same model. They applied it to S matrix study or LSZ study for Lorentz invariance breaking. The kick here actually breaks Lorentz invariance, but that is what they were interested in, but we are interested in the isocurvature part of it, or looking at the quantization and then what fluctuations you get. But this is also in those models.
At least in some context, there are parametric resonances in this.
Mm-hmm. If it starts spinning at a certain specific rate within a certain window, you avoid all the parametric resonance. But then as soon as it goes beyond those bounds, you get huge parametric resonance, the isocurvature kind of doesn't make any sense. You get fragmentation starts happening and all sorts of troubles. So,
can I ask a question? So contrasting this with the previous scenario was just rolling down. Is that the only difference?
Yes, that's the only difference. No, there's another difference. Previous scenario, it was rolling down along pi square. And
it looked like a 5-4 potential. I mean, this thing is the 5-4.
Yes, again, the problem is, I think I should correct this. This is a caricature that I'm trying to show. This looks like it is actually a 5-4 potential here. It is a 5-4 potential here.
Yeah.
It is a caricature, but when I consider the SUSY model, the rolling down is taking place along a 5-square potential, and that 5-square potential also looks exactly like this, except the one direction is 5 plus, another direction is 5 minus. In the 5 plus and 5 minus plane, it has this kind of a shape, but the potential is 5 square there. And there is only one theta direction that we are rolling along. The theta doesn't change. So if I'm going around this, I'm actually just rotating in 5 plus and 5 minus phase space without doing anything to the theta.
But can you go back to the potential? Because, I mean, if I combine, this is your potential. I mean,
yes.
5 plus times 5 minus to the S square.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's rolling along this, and this is a flat direction, which makes sure that the quartic term doesn't really kick in for a long time. Only when it deviates away from flat direction will the quartic potential actually start kicking in. But in the spin part, we were interested in, can I get isocurvature without parametric resonance, without fragmentation, from a 5-4 potential? Now, that's tough because you get these parametric resonance. But if I have this spiral motion, then I can still get a good isocurvature in usual vanilla 5-4 potential kind of situation without any extra field. So just a single 5 field, no 5 plus, no 5 minus in these kind of simple axion potentials. Yeah, and any questions? How much time do I have?
A couple of minutes,
okay. So I'll quickly just touch upon the last part, which was doing an EFT for this. How do you go about detecting these in future? So let's look at this plot then. So here I'm trying to show this is my adiabatic power spectrum, and let's assume I have two different isocurvatures with different spectral tails, primordial. And how does it look today? This is the linear matter power spectrum. So the blue here is the adiabatic. A slight green tilt will give me this kind of a power spectrum, total power spectrum, which has both adiabatic and isocurvature. And a larger red tilt will give me this kind of a potential, this kind of a power spectrum. We are trying to constrain the parameter alpha, and alpha is the amplitude of isocurvature versus the amplitude of adiabatic. Try to see how much this alpha is. And clearly, this alpha is definitely less than 1 or smaller. It's less than 1 at the pivot scale we define. So we define a pivot scale which is 0.05 megaparsec inverse. To also show, now on the linear power spectrum, you see that the red has a large divergence away from the adiabatic, because although it has a very small quantity of isocurvature, but purely because it has a huge tilt, so it starts deviating away. If I look at the nonlinear power spectrum, that you don't see such deviations. It's a very small deviation, in fact, very light deviation. So the blue is again adiabatic, and red crosses are my isocurvature with a 3.5 spectral index, which is extremely large, and slight amount of isocurvature. So same as the previous one. But now the difference is not much because gravitational clustering seems to negate or seems to vary, because gravitational clustering virializes the structures and things tend to forget their history, which is why even though there is a large difference in the linear power spectrum, the non-linear power spectrum doesn't actually show that much of a difference. And so it becomes tricky, how do you detect this kind of reddish? How do you separate the red from the blue in actual data? And this is still extremely large in terms of what I've shown the values. I'm looking at this value is, alpha is about 0.25, and with 0.25 you get this, but I'm interested in looking at alpha 0.01, so 10 power minus 2, and in those cases, the red and the blue almost go on top of each other. Can data still detect something beyond, those kind of situations? And we'll see Euclid, maybe, but MegaMapper definitely.
Sorry, why 0.01?
Right. So I was looking at the value which the current value is about, so the current value is about order 0.1, which Planck says, and so we are trying to see what about the sensitivities to this order.
At a much bigger scale. Is that not at the much bigger scale of Planck? The 0.1 from Planck.
Much bigger scale in a sense?
Well, Planck's is much bigger scale than this, I guess, than KL.
Does it have to be the same on all the scales?
Or is it
the
same? I don't know. I'm just wondering.
No. I think Planck right now goes max to max up to 0.1 megaparsec inverse in terms of converting from L to what we have to in megaparsec inverse. Euclid will go beyond, and then MegaMapper can go even larger than that. So Planck doesn't give me anything beyond these scales. So it's almost saturated up to this. And so, which is why the constraints from Planck, even though it says this, it says nothing about NI. There's not enough data to distinguish between different spectral indices. And again, even that is hardly 2 sigma. So I won't say it is very much statistically significant. We use EFT of LSS. How EFT of LSS is different from the usual LSS theory is that we start with the equation of motion in a matter-dominated universe for my actual matter clustering together. So continuity equation, Euler and Poisson. Do a perturbation theory, so divide my delta for the matter over density as first order, second order, third order, and also for the divergence of the velocity, the peculiar velocity. The SPT, which is standard perturbation theory, doesn't give rise to a good prediction. So if this is my black dots are my actual n-body data, the one loop SPT and two loop SPT just seems to oscillate. I can do 3-loop, 4-loop, and it still doesn't converge to the actual data. So one approach which was suggested about 2012 or 2011 was to look at the SPT actually treats the whole matter fluid as an ideal fluid. But we know that the matter fluid is not an ideal fluid. It has certain pressure. There are stress tensors. There is going to be a feedback from small scale on the large scales, and then there is gravitational clustering. So to treat that, you look at an effective picture of the matter fluid. And the idea is to actually integrate out all small scale information, just as one would do in a Wilsonian approach. So integrate out all the UV scales, get an effective IR theory, and see the Lagrangian of that IR theory, solve that to then look at the large scale perturbations in the system. So what we get here, instead of just delta or V, we get lambda, where lambda is my smoothing scale, or some energy scale below which I'm looking at. I get this extra term purely because I integrated out all UV scales. I get a residual IR term. That residual IR term is effective stress tensor. So from a theory in SPT which had delta 1, delta 2, delta 3 at one loop stopped there and give rise to these power spectrums, I get extra terms now. So I get an extra term which is C squared has a K squared delta 1 kind of a K squared delta 1 leading term. The parameter squeeze C squared is unknown. It is something which is induced by UV, and because we have no way of knowing what the UV did, this is going to be parameterized from the data directly or from the simulations. So this is a free parameter, just as in a EFT. But then even with one free parameter, the EFT of LSS does much better. It actually fits the data very well. So the red line is my one loop EFT, and then two is the two loop EFT. Going beyond three loop EFT doesn't give as much perks because I'm already very close to KNL and it's perturbation theory. So I cannot grow beyond nonlinear scales. So people usually stop at two loop. People have done three loop EFT, but they have shown you are almost asymptotically reaching the nonlinear scale. So there's no point going beyond two. And why is it called an EFT? There's another reason why it's an EFT, because the parameter C square acts as a counter term. So because certain terms such as 1 and 3 correlation, which is P13, has a divergence, and that divergence has a structure which is exactly same as K square P11. So the divergence in P13 is actually absorbed by K square. And that's what we see here. So I can resolve C square as some lambda dependent term and some renormalized part. And then the renormalized part, the lambda dependent term absorbs all the divergence, all the lambda dependent term, making the theory lambda independent. And the C then square is actually the renormalized parameter there. I think I'll just go back to the final result. So we did this for Euclid and MegaMapper, used EFT of LSS technique, used these values from the Planck, and some, because we are essentially looking at the galaxy data, spectroscopic galaxy data, we have these biases in the halo expansion model. So this here is the first plot here. This part is the Euclid, and this part is for MegaMapper. For Z going, Euclid goes only up to Z2, and MegaMapper starts from Z about 2 and goes to up to Z about 5. So the first plot here is from the power spectrum, what sensitivities we get from the power spectrum for the parameter alpha, alpha being the amplitude ratio. Adding bispectrum data, which is P plus B, doesn't really give us much. And that's because the order which we are working at, while power spectrum can go to one loop in our order, we went to delta to the power fourth. So this is first, we went to up to this order, and at those order, the bispectrum can only go up to tree level. So which is why the data from tree level bispectrum hardly improves upon what power spectrum has already done. The main problem here, as we see here, is due to the marginalization over all the nuisance parameters. So many nuisance parameters, right, from biasing parameters, then you have counter terms. And all those lead to an almost 10 times worsening of our data. So if my constraints, if I knew everything about the bias parameters, I would get something like this. But because I marginalize over them, we end up with the blue. And the most effect is from the Laplacian bias parameter here. So this one here. This has the most effect of all the other bias parameters. And there's a reason why this is the case. This is not the case for adiabatic. The Laplacian bias is important only for blue isocurvatures. It's because of the shape of the power spectrum. And I can talk in detail later. This is, maybe I'll say, the money plot. So this is my Planck constraint. As I said, Planck is about 0.1, roughly 0.5. And has no sensitivity to any of the NISO, NISO being the spectral index, almost flat across all NISOs. Euclid marginalized over all of the bias parameters and nuisance parameters, does worse actually than Planck at very small NISOs. But then on large NISOs, it can do much better. On the other hand, MegaMapper will actually do much, much, much better. The MegaMapper in future can actually, if the 0.5 with Planck, if it's a 2 sigma, and given Planck sensitivity, MegaMapper sensitivity, and if that 2 sigma is actually something and not going to just vanish away, then MegaMapper can give you a 5 sigma discovery. That's something which is really good. But then it depends whether what 2 sigma we are seeing is going to probably vanish or just remain and become more and more good for us. These plots do not consider in this analysis, it doesn't consider RSD, but if I consider RSD, I'll get additional data from the velocity perturbations. So hopefully, I'll get much better constraints. But yes, there is a finger of God effect that can also play and make the situation even worse. It's a trade-off, and I'm still working on it. I'm also looking at some degeneracies, and these are some extensions. I know I'm going over the limit, so if you're interested in these extensions, we can discuss. And yeah, that's it. Thank you. Sorry for the interruption.
Okay, so we've had a bunch of questions. Are there any last questions?
Yes, you go.
Yeah, so you talked about the sort of nonlinear virilization being one of the main limiting factors. Mm-hmm. So I was going to ask about like going after observables at earlier times where they're.
Oh, yes.
So I was going to ask about 21 centimeter observables.
Oh, right.
Some lines on the plot,
yeah.
I wonder if you can.
Yes, so I believe 21 centimeters purely because they're looking at very high seas, And there have been constraints. People have done similar constraint from mini halos effectively. So because there is a large power on small scales, the structure will start forming much earlier than purely adiabatic. People have, I think I saw a paper which said JWST seeing some of these very strange galaxies at very early time is probably because of large small scale power. And that is why we see those galaxies which we should not expect in simple lambda CDM. But then nevertheless, coming back to what you're saying, so with that situation, the 21 centimeter is just trying to see whether there is a structure which was formed previously at some of the high Zs, and if we do get, then yes. The constraints from 21 centimeters can be really interesting because they will be looking purely at linear scales. At very high Z, things are almost linear, and so you get very, very strong constraints. But I believe the papers that we read, there is a lot of optimistic approach, I would say. So many things are just shrugged on. I mean, the errors which, because there is so much sensitivity, I think the issue which we found is that the foreground is very much neglected. The sensitivity of the foreground, if one considers that, then one should reevaluate those estimations for 21 centimeter, especially for blue isocurvatures. Not just for blue isocurvature, but for any situation where there is a small scale power, large small scale power, and reevaluate the foreground effects and see where, because I believe just as halo galaxy and halo biasing, we have nuisance parameters, and that just doesn't give us good information, and we have to marginalize, unfortunately. If one does something similar, we do tend to lose lots of control over the data. But it's a very promising direction, and I have another professor, Raymond Koh from Indiana, and he was trying to suggest maybe we can use that and then try to see for the warm dark matter velocity, try to constrain the velocity of warm dark matter using 21 centimeter. So people are very much interested in that.
Yeah. Am I allowed or not? Am I allowed to ask a question?
Why don't we break the official recording here, and then people are free to speak. So, thanks again.
Thank you.